It's got a death curse.
Don't bother me, be like me. And then who will help you up in the sewer?
Just like having a wardrobe.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.
My mommy always said there were no monsters, no real ones, but there are.
Yes, there are.
There's two kinds of horror movies out there. There's the kind that deal with strict fantasy, and what I mean by that are the vampires, Frankenstein. The kind that deal with imaginary evils. Imaginary horrors. And we as adults, we watch these films and we take solace in knowing that none of this is ever, ever going to happen. It's safe and fun escapism. But then there are the other movies that deal with something a little bit more darker, and these movies tend to disturb more people more often. It's the films that tell the tale of the evil that people do to one another. Films like Last House on the Left, I Spit on Your Grave, exploitation, rape revenge films that really get under your skin, because not only are these movies plausible, they also represent a very real danger that most people can't handle being reminded about. There are monsters out there. And this time around at Horror 101, where we're educating your fears, we're going to introduce you to one. Throughout our history, we've met certain individuals who have committed crimes so bizarre and so absolutely maniacal that it's almost impossible to believe that they happened. Jack the Ripper, H.H. Holmes, Elizabeth Bathory, Albert Fish. You want something to keep you up at night? You wiki these people and read up on why they're famous. I dare you. Tonight, the world-famous Brian Stewart, cult sensation Nick McPherson, the macabre Todd Gervais, and myself are going to introduce you to a 1974 biopic of one of the most notoriously insane people in our recent history. His name was Ed Gein, and his story is the stuff of legendary nightmares.
I'm mad. Renfield is deranged.
Let's put it this way. Without Ed Gein, we never would have had Norman Bates.
No.
Without Ed Gein, we never would have had Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm-hmm. And arguably...
We wouldn't have had Jason.
No, that's a little bit of a different mythos. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have had Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
We would have had Hannibal Lecter. What we wouldn't have had was Buffalo Bill. Because Buffalo Bill was the character who
was skinny and making things up.
Yes. Yeah.
You take all the horrific elements of those three characters and wrap them up into one fucking twisted package, and that's who you had back in the 50s, Edward the Ghoul Gein.
This was a guy who had this overbearing religious mother that brought him up. He was this bumpkin, lived in, what does it say, Plainville, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. His mother ruled his life, absolutely ruled his life.
To quote an excellent movie, he was blessed with an overabundance of mother love.
And basically, once his mother died, he was left to his own devices, and he had like an IQ of maybe 75, 80.
He lived on a 160-acre farm in the middle of nowhere where he was paid not to farm by the government. There was no electricity in this house.
Paid not to
farm? It was a two-story house, but he cut off the top story, like basically sealed it up, and lived just in three rooms all by himself in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, it gets worse than that, though.
Oh, yeah. When this guy snapped, he snapped like nobody in history.
Did he kill people? Yes. He only killed two people, though.
He was only accused of and found guilty of killing two people.
He's not even technically a serial killer.
No, but what he was a maniac, a grave robber, a cannibal, a necrophile, a transgendered fucking wacko. Absolute fucking wacko.
By the time we get to Psycho, Norman Bates had killed enough people that he was a serial killer. He killed six people.
Norman Bates once said that a boy's best friend is his mother. That was exactly the problem with Ed Gein and his mom. She ruled his life and twisted his perception of reality so severely that after she died, he became insane with grief and loneliness, and soon after he began exhuming fresh corpses to bring home to keep him company.
Yeah, he tended to prefer matronly, kind of heavy-set, elderly women, 50, 60 years old.
He would have sex with them. Mother. He would carve them up. He would make chairs and lamps and shit out of their flesh and their bones, so that's where the Texas Chainsaw Massacre comes from.
Nipple belts.
And the
skin faces. Skin. Cut their faces off, tan them.
He had a whole bunch of different skins made from women's skins that he would dress up. He would tell the people later after he was found that he would dress up in these skins and he would dance around naked in them and howl in the moonlight. This was Ed Gein. Nobody knew. Until one day he actually shot and killed this woman that worked at this hardware store.
In town.
And because he wasn't very smart, the receipt book for the antifreeze that he just bought was laying right there. And they're like, well, it says Ed Gein was the last person here, so we'll go check it out. When they get to his house, they find this girl that he shot and dragged to his truck, trussed up like a deer upside down. There's a very popular picture of this beheaded woman up by the ankles, like cut down the
split
the middle.
From chaps to nave.
We actually Googled this picture while recording, and Nick's reaction to what he saw pretty much says it all.
Yeah, oh, that's the photo. Arrived, that's what they found.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, and also that face down there to the bottom right.
Yeah, a true, absolute psychopath. And, like, his whole house was riddled with fucking
psychopath.
Shit.
Sociopath.
A true sociopath.
Yeah, psychopath can't distinguish between reality and...
Out of all the serial killers I've ever heard of, and I find that entire thing fascinating, I spent years reading about him, he's the only one who very easily fit the insanity definition, in that he never covered his tracks. He never did anything to hide what he was doing, but he lived such a solitary and separated existence from everybody else that he was able to do it for a long time before people realized what happened. And in fact, when he was confronted, he confessed immediately. They say that the definition of insanity is if you truly don't realize that what you're doing is wrong. Yeah. He had some understanding what he was doing was wrong, but not to the degree that one would expect.
Security through obscurity?
Ed Gein. He was a nice, quiet man. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Are you totally deranged?
Deranged! That's the magic word, because that's the title of the film we'll be sharing with you today. It was made the same year as Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 1974. It was directed by Alan Ormsby, who had collaborated with Bob Clark a couple years earlier when they made Children Shouldn't Play With Dead Things together. Deranged is a low-budget biopic that tells the story of Ezra Cobb, played by Roberts Blossom, and all the names of the characters have been changed and some of the facts have been altered. It was, for its time, a very authentic and disturbing look at the life of Ed Gein. But before we get into the film itself, there's interesting history surrounding this film, and it involves the day that yours truly inadvertently pissed off one of my idols, Tom Savini.
Interesting story about Deranged. I'll start, Todd. You can jump in whenever you want. We went to expo in Novi. We went to this expo, and this was pre-internet. This was back when VHS was still pretty boss. Like, DVD was just brand new, but we were still collecting VHS.
No, I don't even think DVD was on market yet.
And, you know, like, Todd and I had seen pretty much everything that we could possibly see in the area. Like, we had just Jumbo, Applause,
we watched this city dry.
Yeah, we did. And we were starving for new shit. And we had always heard, like, through magazines and stuff like that, word of mouth, that there was, like, these cannibal movies, like Cannibal Ferox, Cannibal Holocaust, these movies that we would never find in Canada. Not back in the late 90s. Weren't going to find it. They could have been contrary to the morality code or whatever the fuck we have. Yeah. So we went over to the Novi Expo, and this was when we met Tom Savini. And there was a lot of vendors that had these bootleg videos of these movies we had never heard before. And I was like a kid in the candy store, but I wasn't working at the time, so I had maybe 60 bucks in my pocket. And I'm thinking, okay, all these titles are like 10, 20 bucks. Which one do I get? I don't know. So there was Nightmare and a Damaged Brain that said on the front of it, effects by Tom Savini, and I'd never heard of it, and I'd seen The Prowler, The Burning, Day of the Dead, Creepshow, everything he's done. So I'm like, I need this movie, I gotta grab it. The pictures on the back look graphic, gory. I'm like, yeah, I'm picking this up. So we bought that. Todd picks up this orange-covered movie called Deranged, and I'm looking at it going, and it looked very boring. Go ahead.
Little bit of background. I was, at that time, I'd had my comic book store. I was I kind of specialized in alternative press comic books and stuff like that, you know, trying to find myself a niche. So I had some very interesting characters who would shop in my store, and one of them had told me about Ed Gein, and I was really deep in my period of reading a lot about serial killers and so forth, so I was familiar with Ed Gein, and I had a wonderful book that I've since lost that had a list of all the movies that were based on Ed Gein, and one of the ones that was continually mentioned was Deranged, how it was an early attempt. I guess his extended family was very active in pursuing legal actions against anyone using the name Ed Gein, right? They wanted to keep the family name clear of this god-awful mess. And so nobody could actually make an Ed Gein movie. And that this was an honest attempt by some young filmmakers to make an Ed Gein film. But I was looking through, and then I see Deranged. And I'm like, oh my god, there it is. Take up the story.
So we're like, okay, well, Tom's over there. Let's go get him. Let's go meet him and have it sign it. Well, I walked in first, and I'm just this dripping fucking fanboy. I'm like, oh my god, Tom Savini, you know. I'm expecting the ray of God to come in and shine on the man, eh? And the guy, he's all humble, and he's like, yeah, you know, I'm just a kid from Pittsburgh. I'm nothing special. I'm like, yeah, but you did this, that, and the other thing. Anyway, I'm like, can you sign this? And I showed him The Nightmare on a Damaged Brain. And he almost threw it back at me. He went, I had nothing to do with that movie, and he tossed it back at me. And I'm sitting there in, like, shock, disbelief. I'm like, well, it says your name right there. And just as I'm kind of pondering what's going on, he notices this orange case in Todd's hand.
Now, let me take over at this point. You may have been aware that Tom Savini had something to do with Deranged. I had no idea whatsoever. What I knew about Deranged was solely this, that it was about Ed Gein, and it was reported from this one book that I very much enjoyed, that it was a fantastic rendition. That's all I knew. And then all of a sudden, Tom Savini, who, like, I'm kind of in awe as well, basically dives across the table and snatches this thing out of my hand.
And he was all surprised. He's like, where did you find that? And Todd's like, I just bought it off this guy over there. He's like, oh, look at that. He grabs his Sharpie and he signs it. He's like, there you go. No money, no fuck all. He was happy to see this title, you know. He brightened right up. And then we took a closer look at the box, and sure enough, effects by Tom Savini. We're like, holy fuck, I didn't even know this. So, yeah, we came back to Canada. We watched it immediately.
And that was that. Deranged, diffused, a potentially awkward moment between us and the master of horror effects, Tom Savini. And why did he get so pissed off when I mentioned Nightmare on a Damaged Brain to him? That's another story.
I can imagine that would have killed me if I had that, and someone I'd been waiting to see all my life, and I would be crushed.
Well, I'll tell you this. I was ignorant at the time, and yeah, I was like, you know, it was upsetting to me, and I was young at the time that my horror idol just got pissed off by what I had him try to sign. But a guy named Scarpellini or something like that, I know the name's a little bit different, they called Tom Savini in to do the effects for this movie called Nightmare in a Damaged Brain. There is evidence that Savini, at the very least, was on the set consulting. So they brought him as a consultant for the horror special effects. This was like early 80s, 81, 82. He had already done Friday the 13th. He had already done like Creepshow, Maniac. He was up there. He was it. Like Tom Savini was a shining light in horror. So they called him as a consultant. And what I'm thinking is that they didn't want to pay him to do the actual effects. He came in to consult. They probably gave him zero for it. Some other guy did the effects. You can tell if you watch the movie, they're not Savini effects. They're graphic, they're gory, they're juicy, but they're not Savini caliber. Well, what do? They release the movie, and they plaster Tom Savini's name all over it. A horror effects by Tom Savini. They basically used his name to get people to buy tickets, and Savini got real pissed off about it. And to this day, they're both telling different stories. But if you look them up, like I've seen him online in Google here. There's pictures of Savini on the set with that kid with the bow tie. Remember that, Todd? You've seen the movie. So he was on set. So I don't know what to say. But anyway, he's a lot of bad blood there between the director of Nightmare and a Damaged Brain and Tom Savini. Mm-hmm. And that's what had happened to poor little fucking Cash going up with his little movie that he wanted signed. I ain't signing that.
Yeah, but hey, Deranged saved the day. Mm-hmm.
So now that we have some of the history on the real man, Ed Gein, and we shared our little story about finding Deranged, which Brian and Nick hadn't seen yet, it was time to sit and watch it. But not before diving into the 12-year-old scotch that Todd had brought us.
For our listeners. Pour those drinks, sir.
Okay. Gentlemen.
A toast.
To Ed Gein.
To Ed Gein.
That's right.
Sláinte.
Prost. Chin chin.
Several years ago, I covered firsthand the incredible story you are about to see recreated in this motion picture. It is a human horror story of ghastly proportions and profound reverberations. But because it is human, perhaps we can learn something from it. But please, let me warn you. The events have been recreated in detail. Nothing has been left to the imagination. It is not a story for the squeamish or the faint-hearted. Now that you stand warned, we can proceed with our story. It is the story of Ezra Cobb, murderer, grave robber, necrophiliac perhaps, or as you may remember him from those stories of long ago, the Butcher of Woodside.
He's mad. Ezra is deranged. What'd you think, Brian Stewart?
It reminded me of kind of a drive-in feel kind of movie. You know, like that kind of horror film that wouldn't be released to main theaters, but that you have to go out of your way to find. You know, like in small towns, or like I said, a drive-in. And I like that feel to it.
Yeah, it's gritty.
It reminds me of like the kind of movies that you used to be able to find through Rhino Home Video. You know, like those lost, obscure movies, like the old sci-fi movies, or like the old Ed Wood films. But and I think a lot of it, too, had to do with that repeated, you know, cheesy organ music.
Yeah, ever since the funeral, you always hear that coming in.
Yeah, that old rugged cross over and over again.
Yeah, whenever he was about to Ed out, they would freaking play that organ music.
It almost reminded me how in Fritz Lang's Am, how whenever you heard In the Hall of the Mountain King, that was the trigger music for Peter Lorre's insanity. And here, all you hear is the old rugged cross. You know he was getting to that state of mind. You know, getting ready to kill again. But that was a really good musical cue.
So McPherson.
It almost makes me think, what if Forrest Gump went wrong?
Yeah, true.
Yeah. You know, you got somebody who's like sheltered and not very smart, you know.
See, Mama said I'm stupid, used to beat me with a rubber hose.
What's it? He gets up and says, "Run for it, Mary!"
He plays the part as a very kind of, I mean, he may be simple-minded, but he knows what he's doing, and he fesses up to it, and there's a strength of character there, because he's always honest. He goes about what he's doing, he doesn't flinch from it, but he plays the part like an old classic Hollywood actor, like almost like Henry Fonda or Robert Duvall would have played the part if it was more mainstream. You know, that kind of strong, silent figure, you know, and it's almost off-putting the way he so calmly and devoutly carries about his business. You know, if he doesn't even waver or hesitate. He's not like Anthony Perkins at all. Perkins the Psycho is very shy and sheepish and hesitant and doesn't like doing what he's doing. There's none of that in this. You know, it's an entirely different kind of character.
It's a little bit off from the way that they portray, like Todd said earlier, a true maniac is somebody who doesn't know that he's doing wrong.
Right.
And this one, he gives you hints that he knows that what he's doing would not be accepted. Like when he gets pulled over by the cop, he flips out and covers the corpse.
Well, she wanted to come home, Sheriff. She told me she did. Otherwise,
now look, yes. This is a 35-mile-an-hour zone, and you were going 50 if you were going anything.
Just think how many times over the course of the film he confessed to what he was doing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Boldfacedly confessed.
And nobody would buy it, because it was just so fucking outlandish.
He started right off the bat confessing to the police officer. The fact the police officer was so put off and not paying enough attention, you know, was his failing, not Ezra's. Ezra made the confession.
Mama? Brought you some soup, Mama?
Good and hot today.
Robert's Blossom, though, he was perfect for that role. The old fucking nutball coot in the, Midwest, whatever.
In the beginning, when he didn't know what to do for his mother, when she said, you know, here, just eat something, because that's the cure for death, right? Yeah. She's dying. Just keep shoving more food in her mouth, that ought to fix her.
Well, like I said, the first time I watched it, she starts puking up all that blood, and he's trying to scoop the blood up with the spoon and put it back into her mouth.
He doesn't do it in such a way where it's comedic. He does it in a way where he honestly thinks he's trying to be of help. And it's kind of like that. It's so sad in a way.
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking.
Imagine the pain of watching everything you ever loved, the only person who ever mattered to you, expire right before your eyes.
Please, Mama. Please, Mama, don't leave me. Mama, don't bleed. Don't bleed. No. Mama.
No, don't bleed. Don't bleed. You're just like, oh, poor guy, eh?
It's okay, we'll just put it back in. Yep. It's all right, it's cool.
It's nothing.
So Ezra's mom passes away, they bury her, and suddenly this grief-stricken man is all alone in his house for the first time in his life, and we get to witness his pain quickly transform into a terrifying psychosis.
When are you coming home again? I'm real lonesome, Mama. There's nothing but snow and snow.
That endless 360-degree pan giving you idea, yeah. Because he pretty much lived his life in that one room, because he didn't go in his mother's room too often, right? That was Mom's room. He had that kitchen. He even slept in it.
Well, if you want to know about a character without ever saying anything, without them telling you themselves, just show them the room they live in. Show them where they spend their time.
Exactly. And, you know, just that, the way it, you know, it comes through that whole, he's talking to his mother, and all of a sudden you hear, you know, when the image does not have any person in it, you hear the voice of his mother. And his response isn't one of, like, immediate acceptance. It's a cry of terror.
If you miss me so much, why don't you come and bring me home? Mama!
It sets up extremely well that this guy is divorced from reality.
And it's also a way, with the camera rotating, of trapping us within his mindset. And it's really kind of, we're now part of his world. There's no getting out. Mm-hmm. The camera's encircled. There's just, all the walls are in place. And, you know, we're kind of sealed into his mind.
The fact that, you know, when the, it starts with him lying there, crying. You know, oh mother, I'm so cold, I'm so lonely. And it pans down, and you see the blanket isn't up on his feet, and he's bare feet with the long nails hanging out. He's talking about how cold he is. And then that there's no human contact. It's just this cluttered, dirty room when this whole thing with the mother started responding. And the fact that when the camera finally completes this pan that seems to take forever and comes back on him, it's Mom's voice, but you see...
Yeah, he's moving his mouth. Yeah.
Yes. And that's when... Yeah, it's like, yes, okay, we're now going to spin you around because welcome to the new world of insane Ezra Cobb.
And we broke him.
Yeah, exactly.
You should be ashamed of yourself, leaving me here more than a year now, all alone here in the dark.
Ezra exhumes his dead, rotting mother and brings her home, talks to her, dresses her, completely unaware of just how deranged he's become. And if this wasn't bad enough, wait until he figures out what an obituary is.
You mean I can find out where and when somebody been buried? On the very same day? Well, I'm going to look into that. This here could be real valuable information.
Why? What are you planning to do? Dig him up or something?
No, sir. Wouldn't have to dig it all up. Like, if you need the head for repairs or something, well, then just take the head.
You're crazy, SOB.
Yeah, laugh it up, fuzzballs. This guy ain't playing around. And before you know it, he's digging up his Sunday school teacher and a bunch of other fresh ladies. But grave desecration is one thing. Murder is much different. And when Ez targets the barmaid Mary and cons her back to his place, leaving her in his truck so long that she's forced into his lair in the middle of the night to look for him, talk about fucking willies.
When she walks in and she turns around and she sees the corpses.
Right.
And the one on the ground suddenly starts moving, cranking the organ. And they go in and you realize it's Ezra in a woman's skin and scalp playing the organ.
But even then, the way they staged that shot at first, you see the arms start going, you're just kind of like, what's he doing? I thought the same thing. I thought he was jerking off. I thought he was fucking pulling it.
I did too.
It cuts to him cranking
and
the organ.
And in fact, I guarantee...
It would have been more disturbing if he was.
But think of the year. I guarantee they were referencing that's what he was doing by showing that
shot. Oh, yeah.
I still think having all the friends around the table was a reference to Sunset Boulevard. That moment they said they all sit around, they play bridge together. If you've ever seen Sunset Boulevard, Gloria Swanson sat there around the room, and if you look, the other people at that table are old silent movie actors, and they were called her waxworks, all of her old friends. And it kind of, like, there are hints to other movies, like, to that kind of era, like, you know, Gloria Swanson was somebody who, for all intents and purposes, probably should have been dead. She was a bygone relic of a past age. Mm-hmm. So you get that kind of hint, eh? That the mother is this... She's not really a star anymore, except in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really clever. I mean, there's some nice little touches here and there.
You know, 10-1 says you feel a lot better if you eat something.
I would eat, but I can't.
How come?
My hands.
Oh, that's true. Ain't it? But if I untie you, you'll try something.
When he had Mary tied to the chair, and he's like, you know, starting to rub up on her, and you see his hand go under the bra, just for a split second, it's like, fucking amateur. You don't twist him like that. What's wrong with you, boy? You'll break him off.
It's like watching a bunch of retards trying to fuck a doorknob out there.
I have no idea what I'm doing.
A little bit of crazy comic relief comes when Ez goes on a date with Maureen Selby, played by Marion Waldman. She was the house mother in Bob Clark's Black Christmas. And why does Ez agree to try to romance this living lady?
She's fat. I know I can trust hers. She's fat.
They lighten the mood, you know, with several parts. Like, for example, he's sitting there talking to the desiccated, decayed corpse of his mother about the lady who wants to have the seance.
One thing bothers me about her, though. I don't think she's all there.
Not right in the head.
Right in the head.
No, but there's a part of the head. I better bring protection.
Yeah.
The only thing that bothers me, I don't think she's, all there. In upstairs. You know what I mean?
That whole sex scene. It was just the most awkward, disturbing, not sexual in the least.
Anti-sexual.
Anti-romantic.
Of course I'm flashing everybody. I have the weirdest boner right now.
That whole bizarre seance. I mean, how desperate is this woman? But, you know, it almost reminded me of the first time my friends and I watched the... there was a movie produced by Ed Wood, but not directed, based on the novel by Ed Wood. A movie called Orgy of the Damned. Have you ever heard of it?
Orgy of the Damned was in Fright Night.
Orgy of the Dead, which was a movie that involved, I think, 11 naked women that just danced for 5 to 10 minutes. And at no point is there anything even remotely sexual happening on screen. And, you know, you're watching this, and I'm pretty sure a prolonged exposure to that movie would render you sterile. It's just like...
It would be official. Your penis is only like, for decoration after that.
Yeah,
yep. It's a garnish.
This dancing does nothing for me.
Of course, we come to the end of the story where Ez carries out one final atrocity, and through his carelessness, he leaves a trail of death from his final murder right to his back door. The authorities find these clues, and the game's afoot.
Well, according to the register, you and he were her last customers.
Us?
Hmm.
Ezra bought some Addy for you.
Yeah, said he was going to take it out to
Ezra
his...
Ezra Cobb?
Yeah, he was in here when we were.
No, Danny, I'll bet he did something. I'll bet he did.
Who, Ez? He wouldn't. Now, you know Ez wouldn't do nothing
He's
like this.
He's crazy enough to do anything.
Look, I've known Ez for 25 years, and I tell you, he could not do
if it. If only you want to go out to his place and take a look, huh?
I have to say, just speaking about the cinematography, just about the entire effort of making it a film, I like the way they closed it as well. That he had a moment of epiphany just before he's arrested.
Ezra! Ezra! The wages of sin is death! Do you know what God done then? Don't you, boy? He burned him in hell! Death! Death! Death!
No!
You know, he's sitting there, he's beginning the process of carving the girl. And, you know, his mother comes back in this flashback, and he seems to have the realization that, you know, he's crossed the line.
He's done wrong.
Yes, exactly. Or, and I thought that, just in terms of creating a complete story as a movie, that was a wonderful ending.
Or that, or he's at the breaking point where he's going to get even worse, and if we hadn't stopped him then and there, it was going to be even more disturbing than it already was. You almost feel like there's a sense on the part of the filmmakers, too, that they had some foresight as to how the movie was going to be accepted, because both it and Texas Chainsaw Massacre both begin with the newsreel footage, talking about the actual story and the events
what
as a true story.
What year was Tobe Hooper?
Same one, 74.
74, because really? They both start the same way with that kind of, you know, an authentic approach saying this actually happened. So you have some reason for showing it, that it's not just chaotic madness and blood and guts, that we're doing it to try and give you a sense of what happened, that there is some kind of methodology or some kind of, rational reason for making the movie.
And where Texas Chainsaw Massacre was an embellished kind of based on true events, whereas there was a nutball cannibalistic necrophile, we're going to make this family kind of in that image. This movie is basically how Ed Gein was, how he grew up.
Yeah, I mean, with
the movie doesn't give you a fraction of his madness, though.
No,
because he was left to his own devices for what, like 4 or 5 years?
15 years.
15 years.
The death of his mother, his arrest.
So you got to imagine there was
like
hundreds
of corpses
littering that place.
He robbed 500 graves. Having just moved in back from an extremely rural area, a town that was only 400 people more than Plainsfield, Wisconsin was in 1958, I'll tell you, there are some folks out there living on their little 160-acre sections who, if you want to be left alone, yeah, you're pretty much left alone. You know, you could go rob graves all day, all night, you know. Nobody's paying attention.
I would say the difference between this and Texas Chainsaw is that they really do... I mean, for all of the lunacy that you're exposed to, it's somewhat polished. They do round off the edges a bit so that they try to give us an insight as to why he is the way he is. They give the relationship with the mother. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is just unbridled madness. At no point in that movie does it feel like that movie is scripted, that there's a director, that there's a cameraman who has any sense of what he's actually doing. It is so chaotic and so disjointed, it feels like pure madness on film. This is not that. This is very tailored, polished. It's like they were trying to, you know, give us like a spoonful of sugar with the bitter pill of Ed Gein.
It was a biopic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even then, when they do the news footage at the front, all I get is like, yeah, by the way, just in case you didn't know, people are awesome. This really happened.
Yeah.
People are fucked up.
Yep.
What do I tell you, listeners, every chance I get? If you're going to experience a horror film for the first time, then make sure you get the uncut, unrated version of that film, if the option is available to you. Because the difference between the R-rated cut and the unrated version is profound. Sure, you'll get gore in the R-rated version, but all the real juicy effects will be gone, and much to my dismay,
After we watched Deranged, Todd remembered a bunch of Savini effects that were omitted from the DVD I had. Such an embarrassment. The fucking thing was butchered.
This had some gore in it, you know, like sometimes the color of blood wasn't quite the red that it should have been. It was very mid-70s, kind of Dawn of the Dead blood that Savini used.
Some of the blood seemed really thick, too.
Yeah.
Thick and bright red.
Yeah. So Savini, he didn't perfect his blood, I would say, until Friday the 13th. Once Friday the 13th, the first one, that's when the blood was crimson. It ran perfectly. You can see in Dawn of the Dead, he hadn't perfected his blood yet, but it was a work in progress, and you can see it in this one.
Well, yeah, it shouldn't be that opaque and shiny.
Well, but in this one, like, he's got decapitated heads and skins, and he's scooping eyeballs out, and the effects were good. You saw it in the trailer.
Hmm.
It was a good job for his second film.
Oh, yeah, it's like, I'm not going to fault him, especially knowing that it's his second film, that the blood wasn't perfect.
Exactly.
But, I couldn't do better, so as he's going to shut up.
I actually appreciated seeing the kind of more primitive Savini blood, because ask any special effects or makeup artist, even when we talked to Cleve Hall back when we did the Nightmare convention,
right?
They'll tell you the same thing. Every makeup artist has their own recipe for blood that they will never share. Mm-hmm. It's closely kept a secret as magic tricks between magicians. And I think it was kind of neat to see, because we've all seen the later Savini effects where he nails it, where it's perfect. Mm-hmm. And to go back in time and to see the development of his craft, I think is kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
I was a bit concerned that Todd and I had overstated the importance of Deranged, given our nostalgia with it, but both Nick and Brian enjoyed the film and scored it fairly high, and since this movie is slated to make its debut on Blu-ray later this summer, I thought it was an excellent time to feature it on the show.
I'm going to give it a solid 8.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Nick?
I'm hoping that the Blu-ray release, when it comes out, is like maybe uncut or has everything, because I will watch it again, because I feel like I'm missing something now. You know, you guys are like, oh my god, this is amazing! And now I'm just like, oh man, I got that cheap version.
Yeah, we sold you a bit short on this one,
apologize. Yeah, you got the made-for-TV.
I got the mother-freaking snakes on the mother-loving plane, you know? So this one, I'm going to give it maybe 7.5. But I'm reserving judgment for when I get to see the full cut.
And we can't say enough about the performance of Robert Blossom. He had a distinguished film career since the 50s. He was a man who excelled at being the old eccentric. You can find him in Close Encounters of the Third Kind and John Carpenter's Christine.
Probably the only thing my brother ever loved in his whole rotten life was that car. No shitter ever came between him and Christine. If they did, watch out.
Mr. Blossom died at the age of 87 on July 8th, 2011. And although Deranged is not a perfect film, it represents a haunting look at how bad the human mind can and has snapped. And for some of us, it was, back in the day, a significant find.
We were fairly impressed with the caliber of the crew on this movie that we had never heard before. It was completely off the map. Who heard, you know, I've been a huge horror fan since I was 9-10 years old. I'd never even heard of Deranged, and yet here it was. You know, crafted by Tom Savini, the guy's been my idol for 10 years, never heard of the film before. It was a great find and a wonderful purchase, Todd.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful purchase.
And that's it. That's the Deranged Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. We're sorry that this one took so long. It's been a few weeks since we came at you at the house by the cemetery, but June has been an incredibly busy month for everyone over here, and I will not rush these shows out to you. I want each and every one of them to be the level of quality that you've come to expect from us. And make sure to wiki Ed Gein and get his full story. It's both fascinating and terrifying all at the same time. There have been many films made about him, and his history has enabled a bunch of horror favorites, influencing great artists like Hitchcock and Tobe Hooper. For the world-famous Brian Stewart, cult sensation Nick McPherson, and the macabre Todd Gervais, this is Cash Wampum, reminding you that there's a horror movie out there that's just going to scare the hell out of you, and we're going to help you find it, right here at Horror 101, Educating Your Fears.